week of November 13th, 2016, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 344, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New Trump City, I'm Michael Giltz.
Ay, 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 New Trump City. Have they already started naming cities after him?
Well, yes, they have.
Well, I know that, Michael, before we get into the whole election thing, I should probably say up front here that next week there will be no show because
what?
I am headed to Brazil. No, I'm not fleeing the country.
Brazil, your hearts went attained in June.
Yeah, that's actually a great Pink Martini song, in fact.
It's not their song. It's a standard.
Yes. But I can tell you that I'm going for Expo Cine.
What's that?
That is the CinemaCon of Latin America. So it's basically a trade show for exhibitors and movie theater owners and distributors from throughout the world, but also it focuses on South America, Central America, Mexico, all of Latin America.
I'm sure it's the same stuff everywhere, but what is there any particular issue that is high on the agenda in Central and South America that we wouldn't think about? What is the hot button issue for them? It's probably the same as it would be anywhere else, but maybe not.
Well, I would say accessibility and release schedules and release windows and, yeah, the same. It's the same as
isn't that
places.
All unifying around the world? Aren't they getting more and more movies at the same time as the rest of the world?
Oh, yeah, I meant the release window between when something is in theaters versus when it's available for streaming or home video.
I do know that there is a different schedule for TV shows, at least in the UK. I noticed for a long time, and I think we mentioned it, that the seasonals box set would be available even when the show was on the air still. And
right.
Of course, a lot of the shows are 6 or 10 or 12 episodes as opposed to 22. But they would almost always have it available right as soon as the show ended. So that if you'd just seen the series or just wanted to catch up, there it was in the store. Those are the days before streaming, but that was pretty notable. But for movies, I assume there have been some differences around the world. But I assume more and more with the multinational corporations that they basically say this is the best way to make money and this is the way we're going to do it. But you let us know. So no show next week because you're coming back Sunday night. Why aren't we having the show?
Because
you're around Monday, Tuesday. I know it's Thanksgiving week.
Thanksgiving week, yes. So I'm leaving almost immediately.
Oh, okay. So you're going away for a vacation. But we will be back the week after Thanksgiving to talk about the holiday box office and Fantastic Beasts and all of that, right?
Yes, indeed we will. And I know that long before the days of streaming, Michael, you actually, you know, we have somebody here on this show, in fact, that has interviewed Donald Trump.
That's right. There is no degree of separation between me and the president-elect. Was it the New York Post? I think it was the New York Post. I interviewed Trump when he launched The Apprentice.
Did he tell you this show's going to be huge?
Yes. No, he absolutely. Of course. He also told me he was responsible for my parents getting together.
Really? What? How is that possible?
The first major purchase he did on his own was called, I believe, then the Hotel Continental. It's on 42nd Street above near Grand Central, part of Grand Central practically.
That's right.
And it's now a big hotel where athletes stay and even was back then. My dad worked there in the 1950s. My mom worked there. She was the first woman to work the front desk. And that's where they met. And that was, of course, long before Trump. But he bought it, I believe, in the 70s. And I mentioned that, you know, that was where my parents were. He said, see, I brought them together. I'm responsible for your parents. Like, okay. Even then, taking credit for things he didn't really have anything to do with. But, I mean, you've met him too, haven't you?
Yeah. I mean, look, most New Yorkers have in some form or another.
I don't think so. They haven't really met Donald Trump.
Yeah, well, okay.
They've seen him maybe. They've heard of him, but they haven't actually met him. I'm not playing up that thing. When he's a celebrity, he crosses a lot of paths with people in the media and such, but you know.
Right. I would say probably the best story I have is when I was a freshman in college. It was 1989, and one of my classmates, her brother, was directing a spec Coke commercial, which is basically like saying, I'm directing a commercial to put it on my reel. It's not going to be a real commercial, but
He was a college student?
No. This was a commercial director that was kind of just starting out at the time.
Oh, I see. So how much would the budget be for this?
Oh, it was, I think, $20,000.
So pretty good amount. Was it out of his own pocket? Basically?
Yes, it was.
Right. So he's saying, I want to show I can be a commercial director. I'm going to do an ad for Coke, even though Coke hasn't hired me.
Correct. And, you know, there was an actress on set that was, drinking the Coca-Cola. And at the end of the day, Donald Trump showed up. And I thought, this is really, really odd. What's Donald Trump doing here? He's promoting his book, maybe. I don't know. What's he doing here? And then, you know, met him. And then 2 days later, the news broke that Donald Trump was having an affair with Marla Maples, who happened to be the actress that was starring in the Spec-Co commercial.
Oh, wow. Well, there you go.
Needless to say, the $20,000 that filmmaker spent of his own money making that Coca-Cola commercial, Entertainment Tonight gladly paid for the footage. So I think it was Entertainment Tonight. Yeah, paid for it.
Well, okay. So if our president-elect, he's going to be on 60 Minutes tonight, if he listens to this podcast, which I'm certain he doesn't, what will he hear us talking about?
Well, Michael, you know, we don't cover politics on Showbiz Sandbox per se. However, we do now. Yeah, we do provide analysis and commentary of the worldwide media and entertainment industries. So on this week's show, we're going to discuss the role, and some might say the culpability, of the news media in the outcome of the 2016 presidential election. While there is no doubt some divisiveness over the election of President-elect Donald Trump, there seems to be unanimous consensus that mainstream media blew it bigly. We'll also take a look at the impact the results of this year's presidential election will have on the entertainment business. Deals currently in the works may have a tougher time getting approved, and decisions that passed years ago may be in danger of being overturned. During our book filter segment, Michael will name his top pick of the week, as well as the title that any person who can quote dialogue from The Godfather is going to want to purchase. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the rest of the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. We pulled information from everyone else, the usual suspects, and the number one film again is Disney's, or should I say Marvel's, Doctor Strange. $103 million worldwide, just about to hit $500 million come Monday. So a big success story for Disney yet again. This really is you know, they're just batting 1,000 with the Marvel movies.
Now, you saw the movie, correct?
I did, and I didn't like it.
Okay, well, I will tell you a little story. My 10-year-old daughter wanted me to type up her book report for her, okay? So, because, you know, she's 10 and she can't type. But, you know.
How are you going to learn, sweetheart?
Exactly. That's why I didn't. And she kept coming in to the studio here, and she kept saying, "Papa, I want to bargain. Papa, I'm here to bargain. Papa, I'm here to bargain." She kept coming in and saying that to me. And anybody who's seen the film will know why that's kind of funny.
Oh, you took her to see the movie?
Yes.
Did you give her acid? I mean, what a bizarre movie to take a 10-year-old child to. Oh, my God. Did she like it?
Yes, she did. Yes.
Oh, that's very funny. I was just trying to figure out why she calls you Papa. Like, she sounds like some German child from the world. Papa?
Well, I don't know. Maybe she looks at me and says, you look like a Smurf.
That's right. Our number two movie is the animated film Trolls. They're not related to Smurfs, but they are a toy, I think,
yes,
that has been turned into a movie. $53 million worldwide. That's a lot of pencils. $222 million and counting. So that's off to a solid start. It had a good hold. There's not going to be a pure family film for a little while, even though next week is Fantastic Beasts. So we'll have to see what happens with that. And number three is Arrival, the Amy Adams film, which got pretty good reviews and pretty good box office for an adult film. $34 million over the weekend. It's in 26 territories. It got good reviews. My one question for you is that I think it was Box Office Profits said they've only opened this movie in 2,300 screens. It got good reviews. Why are they only opening it in 2,300 screens? Isn't that plenty?
It depends. It depends on the screens. You know, in some cases, you can open up on 2,300 B-list screens, and no, it's not going to be enough. But in this case,
they didn't have any, didn't leave any money on the table.
I don't think so. No, I think that this was definitely going to be a thinking person's sci-fi film. It was the anti-Independence Day. You know, it was like the exact opposite of Independence Day. And so I think that they wanted to kind of figure out how to market the film and put it out there in a way that made sense. And it seems to have done quite well.
But even if it was 23 not high quality screens, that's still a lot of capacity. That's a lot of bandwidth for box office, right?
Yes.
Are you now saying that 2,300 screens is like a limited release? Is that the nutty proposition that they're making?
No, absolutely. That's a wide release. That is a
I know, but they said why so few screens, as if Don't they believe in the film? That seems to me a huge amount. You could make $100 million on 2,300 screens.
You know, you keep saying that. You said that in the past, and I really actually want to. You know what? I'm making a note to do a post for Celluloid Junkie on whether that's true or not. I'm going to interview people from, I guess I'd interview, you know, the heads of distribution on whether that statement actually holds water, and it might.
My understanding is that at least 5 or 10 years ago, that I believe it's over at the time they were saying, once you get beyond 1500 screens, that's where you're making, like, as you say, high quality screens, that's where you're making 80-90% of your money. The next 1,000 screens are just gravy. You know, you're just making secondary, or you're making it easier to have, you know, 70% capacity in 2 screens rather, you know. So that's my understanding, that you can easily with good screens, you know, make a ton of money, and that most of your box office is coming from those big screens, and that the secondary, the small mom and pop, the drive-in, the whatever, you know, that those are the places where you're making pennies on the dollar. But find out. That would be a good question to know. And especially it's changed today because of, you know, multiplexes.
Right.
There's a lot more smaller screens than there probably were 15 years ago even.
Well, indeed. In fact, you know what? There are more screens in China this month than there are in the United States.
Oh, did they just pass?
They surpassed it. This is, this month or this week. Yes.
Congratulations, China. At number 4, a movie that's not playing in China is Almost Christmas, a movie starring Danny Glover and Omar Epps and Monique and all sorts of people. It's a holiday-themed movie, obviously. $15 million over the weekend. Very good opening for a movie that only cost about $15 million. At number 5 is Hacksaw Ridge, the Mel Gibson flick. I almost said Clint Eastwood, but it's Mel Gibson. $14 million. It's now at just under $40 million, which is also that movie's budget. And of course, it was Veterans Day here in the United States. Not that President-elect Trump cared or did anything about it, but it was Veterans Day on Friday. So the movie might have had a slightly better hold because of that. At number 6, another veteran-themed film is Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk. It finally opened after some film festivals and a lot of attention. It opened to $13 million worldwide, including those screens in China. It's the number one film in China. It beat out Doctor Strange. Here in North America, it opened on 2 screens, and it did about $60,000 per screen, which, weirdly enough, people are saying that's not that good. It could have done a lot bigger. Other recent films did much better. It opens on 800 screens next week. We'll have to see how it does. I've heard a lot of negative feedback for the look of this film from actual, you know, our friend Stephen Garrett, our longtime film critic Aaron Rich. He just thought the movie looked terrible, and not because even the Hobbit thing. He just thought it was terrible. You know, just really thinks the visuals did not work at all. It's awkward. It's strange. It's weird. They're not happy with the film on any level, frankly, but they do think that the visuals of it are just bizarre.
Yes, I've heard this time and time again. I think and we've talked about this in past episodes, where when people saw it as a demo, they thought, wow, it looks amazing. He's finally, you know, somebody's finally conquered high frame rate and 3D and, you know, that hyper real look. But then when you're watching a movie and a narrative and it's 2 hours long, well, that may not work.
And most people will not see the movie that way, because when it's expanding, it's going to be on screens where you're just going to be seeing some of the effect. You won't be able to see the full, absolute perfect effect that he's trying to achieve, because they simply don't have the technology in most theaters.
Correct.
And before Ang Lee tells me, hey, give it a chance, it's new technology, you got to give it a break, I hear you, buddy. I'm with you, even though your last 3 movies have not been good. But, you know, okay. But let's just remember, the first time you do color, people lose their minds. They love it so much. The first time you do sound, people are flocking to the theaters. The first time you went to a theater and they had multi-channel sound and the helicopters flying over your head, you said, oh my God. The first time they did good 3D, even crappy 3D in the 50s, people said, this is awesome. So, you know what? If people see it immediately and go, ugh, that's not a good thing. You might want to rethink that.
Yeah, tweak it a bit.
Tweak it, yeah. At number 7 is The Accountant, the Ben Affleck film. Another $12 million, $130 million worldwide. That's now tripled its modestly priced budget of $45 million. Ben Affleck is the top, you know, the top rated star on that movie, so that might mean you want to put a little asterisk by $45 million. But it does make talk of a sequel, which is what they hoped for, now make a little more sense. At number 8, similarly, is Jack Reacher, Never Go Back, the Tom Cruise vehicle. $12 million over the weekend, $130 million worldwide. At number 9, yet another franchise, Tom Hanks in Inferno, $11 million over the weekend, $200 million worldwide. Now, here is a franchise. We're talking about franchises. This is a franchise. This is a Japanese animated film. It's called One Piece Film Gold. It is the 13th animated film in a series. They're all based on a manga, which has been going on since 1997, written and illustrated by Eiichiro Oda. And it's about a pirate named Monkey D. Luffy. He eats some piece of fruit, his body becomes rubberized, and he goes around the world having pirate adventures. It's been a TV show, it's been TV specials, it's been multiple video games, tons of merchandise. And guess what? It is the best-selling manga of all time. 380 million copies worldwide as of last year, and that number is growing exponentially because it's been getting more and more popular. This is a thing that we haven't really heard a lot about, One Piece film. I think we've talked about it once or twice before, but boy, what a big franchise that is.
And it's an animated film.
The film is just one piece of the franchise. But yes, this is an animated film, $10 million over the weekend. I guess it opened on Wednesday or Thursday because the total is actually $10,450,000. That's in four territories, but you know, it's the 13th film. Who knows how much it cost? I couldn't find that out. But wow, what a big property that is.
Now, do you think it will be one of the 27 animated features submitted for the 2017 Oscars? Because that's how many films are going to be, how many animated films are going to be submitted for the 89th Annual Academy Awards.
Well, it's not on the list. It hasn't been submitted. I don't believe it was eligible.
Ah, okay.
You know, you have to have a theatrical release in North America, and it's scheduled for January, I believe, in the U.S. So it will be eligible for next year. But yeah, there are 27 films, which just shows that's, you know, one every other week, how popular they are. And usually you'll have three slots and you can name the three movies and the winner. This time you'll probably have five slots. I'm sure you will, in fact. I'm pretty sure about four of them.
Okay.
I'm not sure about the fifth. I'm almost certain Kubo and the Two Strings, because that company's had a great track record recently of getting on the Oscar shortlist, and it's got huge acclaim. I'm pretty sure Moana will get on there, if only because they want to have Lin-Manuel Miranda at the Oscars. I'm pretty sure The Secret Life of Pets will get on there, a massive hit with really good reviews, and I'm certain that Zootopia will get it, and I think it's going to win. But then you've got like 10 other movies that could be on that shortlist. Will it be Sing, which we haven't even seen yet? Sausage Party for that oddball R-rated version? Finding Dory, though I doubt it. Kung Fu Panda 3. And then we've had a lot of smaller movies on the list in recent years. Miss Hokusai, Long Way North, April in the Extraordinary World. There's a lot of other movies that are creatively good enough that could get on that Oscar shortlist and maybe even bump off The Secret Life of Pets. But I think Zootopia and Moana are definitely locks. And given the early reviews, I think Zootopia is going to win because it's just a terrific movie, and I think it's one of the best of the year.
Well, I certainly look forward to seeing Sing. That looks like a lot of fun. But let's go back to this week's box office. You left off, and I interrupted you just to talk about the Academy Awards, which I will probably be doing until about, I don't know, February. You were talking about One Piece Film Gold, right?
That's right. That's at number 10 on the worldwide box office. And that made $10 million over the weekend. Now the rest of these movies make $8 million, $7 million, $4 million, you know, we're dropping down here. If you have a movie in your territory that made $4, $5, $6 million, and you didn't hear it talked about on the show, or you think it should be in the top 10, and we haven't mentioned it, that's because ComScore doesn't have it, and we didn't pick up on that movie from some other source, like Variety or The Hollywood Reporter, The LA Times, somebody else.
Le Film Francais is another one.
Right, that's one we look at. We look at, you know, Korean box office charts, but we don't catch everything. And ComScore certainly doesn't. So if we're missing a movie, let us know. How can they do that?
They can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @ShowbizSandbox, or you can search for us on Facebook, where our page should come up if you search for Showbiz Sandbox. A lot of people do leave us messages there, and we do respond.
And we'll accept condolences for at least the next 4 years. A couple new movies that we haven't mentioned is Scandal Maker. That's a Chinese comedy with a Christmas theme. There's a Christmas tree and a guy wearing a Santa beard and a woman in a red dress. It made $5 million over the weekend. I'm personally just wondering how you have a movie with a Christmas theme in China. Maybe I'm being stupid. I can understand an overseas movie, but a Chinese film with a Christmas theme. Am I being dumb here?
I don't know. That's a darn good question. I would love to know the answer to that. Dirt@showbizsandbox.com.
Yeah, I know there is. I know there are people of faith in China, and I know they are not gunned down in the streets, but it's certainly not wildly approved of, and there's just tolerance for much of it. And I'm interested about how those get past the government censors and why and how. Maybe it's just normal. It happens on TV all the time, and I just don't understand that. So yeah, I would be intrigued by that. Naomi Watts had a horror film. A lot of big names make horror films in the last 10 years because they want to keep making a couple bucks. Not a big budget movie, and it didn't do well. It's called Shut-In, and it opened to $3.7 million. And then looking down, there's one more movie. It's another horror film I wanted to talk about. It is Split. It's an M. Night Shyamalan film. It's a creep fest starring James McAvoy as a guy with like 23 personalities. It opened somewhere in the world to $2.6 million. The movie only cost probably, I'm guessing here, $5 million. That's what his last movie cost. This one has a slightly bigger names attached to it, so maybe it's six or seven, but it's from Blumhouse. And yeah, they specialize in low-budget movies that make money. So M. Night Shyamalan has gone from being the next Hitchcock to making really low-budget movies for Blumhouse. But now his movies are making money again, at least compared to their budget. So the last movie made a lot of money based on its $5 million budget. This one, when we find out what the budget is, we'll let you know. James McAvoy, very talented actor, but you know, there's M. Night Shyamalan trying to claw his way back up into the big budget territory.
Well, I wonder if any of his films have been released in China, which passed a new film law this week.
Oh, did they really?
Yes, they. Well, they're going to crack down on piracy and ticket sale fraud. That was one of the big takeaways from the new law.
Oh, that's right. And this is part of the question of the slowdown in the box office. Perhaps we know that their companies were, you know, moving money around and pretending sales where they didn't always happen. So that's an interesting. We'll have to see how that has an effect.
Well, and they also, you know, they're kind of making sure that movies don't denigrate China, and meaning the government, really, and that studios don't, studios and talent don't say negative things about China. That's another part of the law.
Well, that's the difference. I mean, always you're not going to get a movie into China where it criticizes the government or celebrates Tibet. And you make a movie about Tibet, they don't want to let you back in the country sometimes, even though we've seen directors who did make movies about Tibet go on to helm with Chinese films, literally films made in China by Chinese production companies. So the rules always change depending on who gets to give approval. But this new idea that, hey, not just Chinese people, but you're a Hollywood actor saying free Tibet, going to be harder for you to get your movie to China. At least that's the impression they want to give you. And it's not so much that they're going to ignore a Brad Pitt film, but it is so much that they hope you'll hesitate before saying something about Tibet in the first place.
Well, in fact, Doctor Strange in the comic book takes place in Tibet in part, and in the movie, they switched it to Nepal for that very reason.
Because depicting Tibet would have been complicated? I mean,
no, they just were like, you know what, that's a third rail, let's not even touch it. Let's just move it to Nepal and call it a day.
Well, I know that their decision for replacing the old one, who is this ancient mystic who trains Doctor Strange, the old one in the comic books is a hoary cliche of the ancient old Asian, you know, master who speaks profundities. And they wanted to shake it up. And they made the character a female and Celtic. And I thought that was actually interesting and a good switch to sort of freshen up a character that can too easily slide into cliche. So while it's disappointing for an Asian actor who could have created a great role, it's good that they sort of, in this case, they, you know, freshened it up in a new way to sort of keep it off balance.
Well, and they've also, the Chinese law, it also adds a new layer of protectionism. 2/3 of all screens in China must be for Chinese films. So even if they kind of lift the whole film quota, which is 34 imported films per year into China, well, you're going to be scrambling for space.
And that's, again, that's a battle between the people who make movies and the exhibitors, isn't it?
Yes.
Right, because the exhibitors say, please give us Hollywood movies, and the guys making movies say, screw you, only show Chinese movies.
Yes, that's pretty much what's going on there.
Right, so it's not that the government has one complete plan. It's that you have power sources, people in different areas of power fighting each other for what's best for their business.
Yes.
You know, you can't think of China as a monolithic one policy when it comes to the entertainment industry. It's not.
No, although what you can and can't do is certainly swayed by what the government wants, frankly.
Right, but the government is some people who have tons of money invested in exhibition and other people who have tons of money invested in in making movies. So, that's right. You know, they're at cross purposes a lot of times. But at least they're not in they're not at Sony, right? You don't have to deal with the Chinese government, but you do have to deal with sometimes your employees and mass turmoil in Sony. You know things aren't going well when I see the headline, studio head Tom Rothman has full support of Sony.
Yeah.
When they have to say you have their full support, something's not good.
Yeah, I think we did touch on this. I don't know whether we touched on this in previous episodes. I know maybe last week.
Ask for consent, and then you can touch on it.
Okay, well, yeah. Yikes. Tell that to our president-elect. Now, mind you, Tom Rothman used to be a 20th Century Fox, moved over to Sony as a producer, and then TriStar, and then was made the head of the studio when Amy Pascal was pushed out after the big Sony hack. And that said, he is known as kind of a hot-tempered person, a hot-blooded studio
who
executive.
Who could imagine such a thing at a studio?
A guy who speaks his mind, can be rough to work for, but he's also known as being incredibly successful. So I think that what you're feeling here is, or what you're seeing here is some of the people who have been at Sony for years, they're just not used to that type of leadership, and they're kind of bristling against it. Certainly, we saw Doug Belgrad leave. And not because he didn't get the job, but he, after a while, kind of just said, okay, I'm going to go off and become a producer after 20-some-odd years at the studio.
So is there real turmoil there, or is it just, oh, the new guy and you people need to accept that he's there and he's not going anywhere?
I think if I were Tom Rothman, I better make some good movies.
Well, that's always true, isn't it?
Yes, although now those first couple of movies have got to be really good because there's plenty of call. You don't have anybody at your watching your back because everybody's pretty much...
Doesn't Sony have more of a long-range perspective than that?
I would hope so.
How long was the last head of Sony in place?
Oh, Amy Pascal. She was there for years. I mean, a decade.
And did she have undaunted success the entire time?
No, not toward the end.
Right. Well, right from the start she did? I'm not trying to put you in, but you know what my point is, you know.
Yeah.
It's like they're gonna pull the plug after two movies just because some people think he's too pushy.
No.
I mean, they place a big bet on him. They like stability, like any investor and any owner should. They like stability. They like a firm hand. They got to give somebody a chance. They're not there to like make friends. They want to make money.
2006 to 2015 is when Amy Pascal was in charge.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good long run.
Yes.
And of course, they're not doing great at the box office. And Warner Brothers says, hey, they're at the New York Times saying, hey, we've got a great story to tell. We've got all these areas, you know, on fire and doing really well. But our film studio is the most visible. And so we get a lot of grief for it. We feel like we've turned things around in a lot of places. And you're going to see the movies coming out strong now. We got Fantastic Beasts next week. Hopefully that's an $800 million franchise. So it's like all the Harry Potter films. And they're saying, hey, we've got a good story to tell. Do you think it's working?
Well, I don't know. The
Did
Fantastic...
people say, you're right, they are doing well?
Not really, no. Not Warner Brothers.
Not when you got HBO. Since the opening week of Westworld, where they touted the opening week numbers, they haven't said a word since.
Yeah, people are talking about it, though.
I don't know anybody who's enjoyed it. I'm not trying to be mean. I don't know anybody who's saying, wow, I'm really loving this show. I have people who stopped watching it, and I got people who watch it and just go, I don't know why I'm still watching it. It still is boring. It makes no sense. I'm serious. I don't know anybody who says forget love. I don't know one person who says I like this show. And you know what? That's just anecdotal, and that's the people I know. But I haven't seen any really good reviews for it. I haven't seen people writing and saying 3, 4, 5 episodes in. They've really caught fire. They figured it out. You know, I've got an open mind. I'm happy to hear about it, but I ain't hearing about it. I don't think this is a raging success story. If it was in the ratings, they would be telling us.
Well, I don't know necessarily whether there's any agreement about Westworld there. And of course, there's a lot of divisiveness regarding the presidential election. But there's one thing everybody agrees on about this presidential election in 2016 is that the media just blew it, completely blew it.
And I don't agree with that.
Really?
Nope.
Well,
let's go through the arguments.
Okay, so where do you want to start with this? I mean,
well, the first argument is that the media had a bias against Trump.
Okay. Well, they certainly, validated him by covering his every breath, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And they, Michael, you say they gave him a free pass, and I would agree with that.
Well, I don't. I feel like, just like the Republicans, they didn't take him seriously. But when he won the nomination, I felt like the media did wake up, and they started doing everything that old school journalism does. They did investigations, they did stories, they looked into every corner of his life, and everywhere they turned, they found ugly, sordid, negative stories, and they reported on them, and there was strong documentation, and they made headlines, and they talked about it again and again. Then they looked at this man who you know, literally was lying every single day about things large and small. He would lie about the size of his rallies. He had a sold out rally, and he could say, I've had a sold out rally. But instead, in a stadium of 10,500 people, he said 27,000 people showed up. It just wasn't true. It was gratuitous. It wasn't about an issue, but they didn't know what to do.
To your point, Michael, my 10-year-old daughter called her 11-year-old sister earlier this week after the election. You're a liar, she said. You're a liar. You're a Donald Trump.
Right. And they didn't know what to do. And for a long time, what you do is you are politic and you say, well, the facts suggest otherwise, or that you quote the other side saying, well, I disagree. And they finally started saying
he's
wrong. He's lying. It's not true. And it was a massive step forward in the standards of journalism, where they said, we don't feel like we have any choice. And once the dam broke, they all did it. Because there was no other way to describe it and be factually accurate. And I felt like they did that. Every newspaper in this country, virtually every newspaper in this country endorsed Hillary Clinton. And many of them did it in an extraordinary fashion. Newspapers that hadn't endorsed a Democrat in 100 years said, we're voting for Hillary. And many of them went farther than that and said, forget about her. This man is a danger to democracy. I don't know how much more they could have done than to stop, take out a two-page front page editorial and say, this man is a danger to democracy and he cannot be president.
I thought it spoke volumes, in my opinion, that after the election results were in, so November 9th onwards, you had all of the cable news networks and many of the newspapers, the big newspapers, trying to figure out what a Trump presidency would be, something that they probably should have figured out after he was officially nominated. They should have said, okay, public, here is what Donald Trump is proposing. Instead, I agree with you, they did a lot of digging into his background and his personal life and his businesses, but nobody actually sat down and said, here's what he's saying he will do when he's president.
Well, and to defend that, he said very little.
There was very little
you could point to and say, what would happen if this happened, other than, well, you're going to explode the deficit and the debt if you do this, and you're going to do that. So there was very, the next thing that they said the media got wrong.
But
was
shouldn't
the
they have
poll.
Pointed that out? Shouldn't they have said, hey, you know what? We're doing. Hey.
I believe they did repeatedly and aggressively. I believe in the last 3 months of the campaign, the media, meaning traditional newspapers and the 24-hour news channels, somewhat accepting Fox, but not even there necessarily. You had a few people. You had Shepard Smith and you had Megyn Kelly and other people trying to, you know, hold on to facts. You just basically had the cheerleader of Sean Hannity. But I felt like the media did what it has done for generations. The next thing that people said the media got wrong was just calling the election. They said they were wrong. They predicted Hillary would win. They told us she would win, and they got it wrong. What do you think about that argument?
I think they did get it wrong. I also think that a lot of the pollsters started looking over their shoulders. They kind of said, well, wait a second. They may have been able to tell based on what the information they were getting back that, hey, this Donald Trump is actually, you know, a little bit ahead here, but gee, nobody else is finding that. So I must be wrong. So I'm going to discount some of this information.
Well, one of the CNN analysts said, hey, we've been in a reality bubble and now we're dealing with actual votes. And people compared it to Fox News in 2012 or 2008, was it, when they ignored what a lot of analysts said and insisted that Mitt Romney was going to win. And so they're saying that what you did then, the other networks did now. Do you think that's valid?
I think Fox News would always say that the Republican candidate was going to win. So it's kind of hard to answer that question because they would do that no matter what.
That's my point. They ignored what the polls showed, and more specifically, the poll aggregators. You can't look at one poll and say, you can. They do it every day and it's a waste of time. But if you want to be sober and analytical, if you look at a broad poll aggregation and do it with as good scientific rigor as you can, then you get an estimate of where you think the election is. It's not magic, but it's the best scientifically based guess that you have rather than your gut or rather than just feeling. And Fox News ignored that and said, we know the polls show that you're winning. However, this time, the networks were in fact reporting the poll aggregators. They were not ignoring the facts in front of them and saying, oh, well, you know, we think she's going to win anyway. They're saying, this is the facts. These are the poll aggregators doing the best job they can, are showing consistently from day one that they both got the nomination to election day that she's in the lead. It's not a big lead. It's 2-6% pretty consistently. If you do look at the poll aggregators like 538, Real Clear Politics, Princeton Election Consortium, and several others. I looked more at Real Clear Politics towards the end because that made me the most nervous. And you saw it with just a 2-point lead. That's within the polling error. And Nate Silver of 538 got screamed at because he was showing her chances of winning at only 63%, 64%. And
well, can you explain what 538 is? Can you explain for those who don't know?
It's a poll aggregating website founded by Nate Silver, who became famous for his predictions using poll aggregation. I believe starting with Obama in 2008 was where he really caught fire. Then he went to work for the New York Times. Now he's gone out on his own. It's a website that uses the scientific methods to look at things, not even just in politics, but even beyond that into sports and entertainment and other stuff. But he made his bones predicting the 2008 election and did great again in 2012. And so people had decided, oh, it's magic. It will always be right. And if it's not, we're going to scream at you. And if media ignores what the polls show and insists otherwise, well, then they have to defend themselves. But if they're reporting what they believe to be reliable, good polling, and it was polling by and large that was within the margin of error. Nate Silver said there's a lot of undecideds. It's too close. It's very close. He could win. He has a 1 in 3 chance of winning. And people screamed at him for saying she wasn't going to win by more. And then the day after election, they screamed at him for not telling them he was going to lose.
Let's move on to this idea that there was network bias. I guess we kind of covered that already.
Yes. That's the hand wringing I saw the day after the election, where NBC and CNN and the New York Times said, oh, we've got to get out into the heartland. We're ignoring the working man. We've got to speak to people more. We're in a bubble in Manhattan, and we didn't know what people were feeling. I feel like if you ever watch regularly or read the New York Times, you hear constantly about people in the heartland. Journalists love going to a town where a factory has shut down and talking to the people. It's their bread and butter. I hear about that all the time. Some of the best books that you see this year are about the working class and people struggling to get by. I hear it nonstop, and I think it is an absurd lie to say they look down on the working class or despise people of faith. It's only true if you're at Fox News. It's not true, and nobody beats themselves up over it more than the liberals at CNN and the New York Times. It's part of their classic, oh my God, we should have listened more.
You know, there's also the talk about all of these surrogates, that you basically had people who were working for the campaign also on the staffs of CNN and Fox News and as pundits, rather than going out and getting true pundits. And political commentators, they basically said, well, okay, you're from the campaign, you can tell us what's going on. And that really kind of, I really do believe that should be, if not outlawed.
Well, it can't be outlawed.
Media outlets should really stop that. They should stop doing that.
I agree. I think having people on the show as paid employees who are basically shills for one side or another should end. Whether it's Donna Brazile and David Axelrod, or Corey Lewandowski, which was the most absurd one. He was just the head of Trump's campaign, and now he's on CNN as a paid analyst.
No, he resigned
He was on CNN. He was on CNN as a paid analyst throughout the election.
Correct.
And he had an agreement not to disparage Donald Trump, as far as we know. He wouldn't even really confirm it.
Yes, I am just pointing out that ended as of Friday, I believe.
Yes, we all know that, I believe,
Okay.
But that was that revolving door that you have between the Pentagon and military contractors, you have today between the people who cover politicians and the politicians and their lackeys themselves. And yeah, I agree, it's ridiculous. It's like, you know,
that's because some would argue there are no real journalists, frankly.
There are real journalists. There are plenty of journalists at many media, TV, radio, and newspaper outlets around the world. You don't need to have a former chair of the DNC as a paid analyst to talk about. You can interview them on the show, but to have them on staff and pay them and treat them as if they're not going to tell you exactly what you know they're going to tell you. That's why you interview people from that side. But you don't have them on as if they're some sort of independent analyst. If they retire and they're done and you know they're not going to go right back in again next year, okay, maybe then. But if someone is just going to tell you what you know, Hillary Clinton's spokesperson is going to say, you don't need to have her on your show as a paid, you know, personality. Oh, ha ha. It's part of the team covering the election when they're literally feeding questions to them. And if that doesn't piss you off, it should.
Well, what do you think this means for old media? Because let's face it, I think that this was a huge shakeup. I mean, other than the fact that the old media of, let's say, television, okay, The Simpsons back in 2000 actually predicted a Trump presidency.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, I think the point here is not that the media was biased or they got it wrong or that they did this and that particularly, but I think it's literally the last gasp of old media. It used to matter who newspapers endorsed and that the seriousness and the level of which they did it. This election, they didn't say, well, we like her environmental policy more than his, or we're a little worried about her tax rate. They said this man is a danger to democracy. You could not get more extreme and passionate than that. And it didn't matter. They did serious reporting and it didn't matter. Arguably, as people are arguing at the Facebook board right now, because people pass around fake news stories. And they people set up a fake news website, have a fake story about a fake murder-suicide pact of people connected to Hillary Clinton's email scandal, and it gets passed around to tens of millions of people on Facebook. And they make no distinction between that and a real news story. How do you deal with that at Facebook? I don't know.
I don't know either.
That has diminished serious reporting. But I think reporting doesn't have the impact it does. Newspaper endorsements doesn't have. People do not make any distinction between a tweet and a four-page in-depth investigative story at the Washington Post exposing the fraudulence that is the Donald Trump foundation.
Well, when it really only takes 140 characters to get your message out, nobody's going to read your 3,000-word essay.
I mean, truly. Almost every website, magazine, and institution that is mainstream from Scientific America. I mean, everybody seemed to rise up as one and say, for the love of God, this man cannot be president. We beg of you not to vote for him. And it didn't matter. And I think that is the last gasp of old media. And it goes beyond just their power to influence the electorate and inform the public. Look at TV ads and online ads. One reason I had confidence Donald Trump would not win was because he didn't buy any ads.
I thought the same thing.
He bought almost none. And he didn't buy online ads. He said, if I can't see it, what's the point? Because he doesn't go on a laptop. He said, why would I buy an ad for online? That's ridiculous. You're like, oh my God. It wasn't like he was, you know, spending his money wisely on online targeted ads. He really spent very little money. And it's a not so subtle secret that TV stations make a ton of money from election campaigns. That is a big part of their profitability.
No, I think everybody would agree that, frankly, the election cycle, the presidential election cycle, which begins 2 years in advance of a presidential election, that's ridiculous, okay? That is, I mean, think about it. If you're the president and you're 2 years in, you're just kind of getting your groove and all of a sudden they're trying to replace you, that's fine. That's what people are always, you know, you're as a leader, you know, you always are, you're not going to be there forever if in a democracy. But give me a break. 2 years, you know why they do that? Because of cable news networks, because of everybody needs that money, and it keeps getting bigger and bigger.
Cable and news networks are incredibly profitable, and Today's Show and Good Morning America, they are on three, four hours a day, 6, 7 days a week.
You gotta talk about something.
Profitable. But guess what? Are those TV ads now not necessary? Is there going to be a major party candidate who says that was a fluke, or are they going to say, maybe I don't need to spend $1 billion on TV ads. Maybe I don't. Will they have the courage to do that? That ain't going to happen quick. But if Donald Trump just showed you're wasting your money and you're not reaching people with those TV ads, you're not reaching people with those online ads, that could be a real bottom line problem for all the media.
Yeah, I think really, here's the thing with Donald Trump and the beginning of his campaign, just from the way it was announced to the way it was covered. The reality, no pun intended, is that he was a celebrity to begin with, and so it was covered. He didn't have to kind of tell people who he was. Everybody knew. And so I think future candidates, unless they have that type of celebrity built into their candidacy, will actually need to go out there and advertise in traditional ways.
So you're saying take a deep breath, don't worry about it.
Correct. Well, I'm not saying take a deep breath, don't worry about it. Definitely worry about it, but take a deep breath. I think you're going to have to look at the next presidential election and the midterm elections to see how the ad spend on for news networks and local networks really plays out.
Maybe, And of course, if we have the popular vote compact come into effect, then you'll have advertising needed more nationwide than in 11 swing states. But anyway, maybe the message there is not media outlets, you know, don't, you know, keep an eye on it, but maybe it won't work for most politicians. When you're talking about running for president, maybe the Republican Democratic Party say, we need Oprah and Ben Affleck on the left, or George Clooney, you know, and on the right, we need, you know, I don't know, Ted Nugent, whoever you want on the right to run, you know, maybe they want more celebrities. Maybe they're going to say, we need celebrities. It's cheaper. It's easier to reach everybody that way.
Well, you know, that's exactly what Michael Moore said after the 2004 election. And he was right in terms of, if you look at what they did with Obama, they turned him into a celebrity. He won. Donald Trump was a celebrity. He won. So
Hillary Clinton's pretty famous worldwide. She's kind of a celebrity. She's kind of a rock star. She sells books. She's popular everywhere she goes.
Well, apparently
she's not. She's kind of a celebrity. She's kind of a world famous figure.
Yeah. Well, you know, look.
And she bought a lot of ads.
Yes. And we could debate this until, as it will be debated by others for, you know, hours and hours and hours. But you said that this election was the last gasp of old media. But will it be the last gasp of print? And by print, I mean books. And by books, I mean it's time for our book filter segment. And book filter
the worst segue ever.
Well, there's no good. Look, this election is.
You don't need to segue. You don't need to segue.
Okay, well, this election has just ruined us. Book filter is a book lover's best friend. And
oh,
Michael.
Who did you vote for?
Who did. What?
Just kidding.
What's the big book of the week, Michael? The one book that you chose out of. There are literally thousands of books being published each week, and you tell us which ones are the ones to pay attention to.
That's right. The number one book of the week is Swing Time by Zadie Smith. She's an acclaimed author, lots of best-selling books. This is the new one. The reviews are a little mixed, but she's as brand name as a literary author gets. She's like Michael Chabon and others, where everybody wants to read it and know what it's like. It's not that she's a John Grisham, but she is one of those big-selling, really seriously taken writers that people want to know how good is it. This one is
like Jonathan Franzen.
Right, exactly. I think this one is falling a little bit better than the last one or two, but perhaps not quite her best, but it's doing a little better than those. Every book she writes will get attention. But for people in the media, there are a couple interesting books. The first one is J.K. Rowling's screenplay for Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. And we're going to wonder, can she get people reading a screenplay? She just got them all to read a play, and she didn't even really write that one. Let's not forget, that book that sold millions of copies was a play, and she just contributed to it with the story section. Now, her name is on it, and she wrote it, and you got a big, fat movie playing in the theaters. How much is this going to sell? It's not going to sell like a Harry Potter book, but it'll be fascinating to find out what it does. Another one that's interesting for media people is Ray and Joan. This is a biography about Ray Kroc, one of the people behind McDonald's, and his wife, Joan. Turns out they made tons of money, and then she helped them give it all away. It's kind of a famous story, and this is a new biography about them. And Michael Keaton stars in a new movie about Ray Kroc, and I think this book could be a slow burner. It could piggyback on the film, and the attention of the movie and a potential Oscar campaign from Michael Keaton could feed right back into this book. So it's coming out this week, but I think it's got a long shelf life. But for people here, and I know you can do this, Sperling, you can quote a line from The Godfather, right? Do you take the gun or leave the cannoli, or do you leave the cannoli and take the gun?
Well, no, actually, you leave the gun, you take the cannoli.
That's right. That's right. I tried to trick you up there. And so for people like you who know The Godfather and have seen it more than once, there is this interesting book. It's called The Godfather Notebook. And it's literally a reproduction of the notebook Francis Ford Coppola created before he made the movie. It's not the script. It is a notebook filled with ideas and commentaries that he made while analyzing the Mario Puzo novel.
He actually covered this when he said he was going to put this together. We covered it.
Yeah, he filled it with ideas. He took it on set. It was like the on-set Bible. He referred to it all the time. And now they're putting it out in book form. It's kind of a pretty cool treat for film buffs. I think if you're a big fan of the movie, this is something you might want to check out.
And, of course, journalist Megyn Kelly has a memoir this week.
That's right. So, you know, bringing it right back to the election, she's got her new memoir out. She details how Roger Ailes did, in fact, repeatedly sexually harass her. That's what Megyn Kelly says. He offered her advancement in favor for sexual treats. When she rejected him, he said, hey, when's your contract up?
Yeah.
She talked to a lawyer, but she said nothing, fearing her career would be over, which is one reason why women don't always come forward, and even men when they're sexually harassed. But when Gretchen Carlson came forward, Fox News came to Megyn Kelly and said, hey, you know, you got to speak up to defend Ailes. And she, instead, she picked up the phone and called Lachlan Murdoch and said, by the way, do you know what this man has done? Oh, and by the way, she also says that the new president tried to bribe her and then intimidate her throughout the campaign. So good luck with that. So that's going to be a hot seller, and we'll see what next time she goes on his show. And he'll go on her show again. I'm sure he will.
I'm sure he will as well. And when he does, it will be a big deal. Because it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, in a major EU ruling that began in the Dutch courts, judges have ruled that loaning out ebooks should be treated the same as loaning out physical books. It specifically questioned limiting libraries to one copy, one user. That's the one copy, one user model, Michael, as you know, when dealing with ebooks, even though that is precisely the model that libraries must follow when loaning physical books. The court did further note that copyright must evolve with technology. Publishers reacted with shock and concern, but it's unclear what will happen next. Can publishers be barred from charging more for an ebook, limiting the number of loans before it must be purchased again? Or must they hand over a book and watch a library loan it out to 10,000 people at a time if they so choose? And if so, why would anyone buy a book ever again? Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop because we're not going to know what the impact of this is yet. They're concerned. They're looking at it. And we usually present this issue initially from the perspective of libraries because I think they get screwed over a little bit. They've been around for generations. They haven't killed off book reading yet. I think there can be a happy compromise between these two groups and what their desires are. But, you know, this is more the publisher's perspective on what's going on here. They're freaked out, and we'll have to see where it ends up. There has to be something better than, hey, you can buy an ebook, but every 40 copy loans, you got to buy a new one, or charging them, you know, 20 times the price of a physical book. So hopefully they'll figure it out.
They're pitching it as simply a creative decision, but Universal Studios is the new owner of DreamWorks Animations, and they're shutting down production of The Croods 2. All involved insist the project had been troubled for a while, but the decision feels a little bit darker than that. 30 employees are now looking for new jobs, though Universal hopes it can find other work for them to do. At the same time, Universal is pulling the plug on the DreamWorks Animation facility just coming online in India. Katzenberg was aggressively expanding it from 260 employees to 350, and now they've all been told it's over, which leads one to wonder. Why exactly did Universal buy DreamWorks Animation if they didn't want to exploit its valuable franchises or talented employees based in burgeoning markets like China and India? Come on, people. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. I mean, I just can't even imagine what's going on here. I can't imagine what was taking them so long to do The Croods 2. Why would they want to be shutting it down? If it has problems, you rip it up and start over again. But this was a very successful film, and you know, if they're going to exploit it as a franchise, as it's, you know, it's that kind of movie, why not?
Yeah.
What the hell's going on? You know, and they said they was already in trouble before they showed up. Maybe, but that's why you put someone new in charge, tear up the screenplay, and start over again. Maybe they could get that guy Katzenberg to help them out.
Talk show host Steve Harvey is shutting down his popular hit in 2017. He's got a hit talk show. And then he's immediately launching a new one right away. His base of operations will move from Chicago to L.A., partly due to his expanding empire, but mostly this is about power and control. Harvey will have more creative control and a piece of ownership, which will mean a lot more money. So here's the deal. You can wake up in the morning, turn on the radio, and listen to Steve Harvey's morning show for 4 hours. In the afternoon, you can watch his syndicated talk show. In primetime access, you can watch him, you know, he hosts The Family Feud. And on NBC, you can watch him host the talent show for kids called Little Big Shots. If you have any free time, you can read his latest self-help book, Big Deal or Big Whoop.
It's a big whoop, right? Steve Harvey makes more money. He's not really shutting down his talk show. He's just gaining more control over it. So more power to him. But when you'll step back for a second, that is an amazing string of success. I mean, that's Ryan Seacrest times four.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Ryan Seacrest has the radio show and American Idol, the number one show in the country. This is pretty damn big, too. It's kind of an amazing, amazing empire he has built.
While Steve Harvey is busier than ever, Robert Redford is pulling back, sort of. The Hollywood legend is 80 years old and just announced that after his next two films, he will stop acting for good. But he's not retiring. Redford says he'll focus more on directing and drawing, though no projects seem to be in the works. He also has Sundance, his philanthropic work, and other causes to keep him in the public eye. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, right?
Well, you know, think about it this way. Think about it this way. If you're directing a film, even if you're the director, if you're 80 years old, think about the insurance ramifications of that. It's really hard as a director. You usually have to have a second to, if you're...
He's not directing. He's got nothing to direct. The last thing he made was a short. He's not even directing anymore. He just doesn't want to say he's done. I mean, he's gracefully stepping into the sunset. That's lovely. That's just why I'm saying it's a big whoop. He hasn't acted that much. He rarely directs. So, you know, maybe he could do another movie, one more, just like Warren Beatty did. I hope he does 10.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a big whoop. He's been slowing down. He's had a good, actually recent renaissance in acting. That's cool. Great. But, you know, he's 80 years old.
We just mentioned that Robert Redford is 80 years old. His age has been widely reported for many years. But you can find the age of even little-known actors simply by going onto IMDb. California passed a law to end that, and now IMDb is... you know, let's face it, we all kind of knew this was going to happen. They are suing the California Attorney General, emphasizing the widespread belief that this restriction against reporting accurate publicly available information is unconstitutional.
Well, maybe we should rethink that with the new Supreme Court.
Yeah, that's true.
Sure, you can ban that.
They filed the complaint last week in California federal court to overturn the law. Unfortunately, everybody was out smoking pot. So, you know, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop. It's right. It's the next step in what we knew would happen.
Yeah. Predictable.
Not being a lawyer, I must say that it absolutely will be overturned. So who knows?
American football ratings always dip in an election year. Nonetheless, the NFL sees a major issue in the fall in viewership across the board, and they're rethinking everything, kind of like the media after this election. Bloat is extreme, and they may be cut or folded into the game in new ways. Games, they're endless, and they may change rules like no clock stopping after an incomplete pass.
Thank you, Jesus.
And a survey of 18 to 24-year-olds don't feel remotely as connected to sports in general as previous generations. They prefer movies and TV shows to sports by margins that are significantly bigger than other age groups. Cord cutting would only exacerbate that trend. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, we've covered this in the last few weeks. I wasn't going to mention the survey because it's like it's a survey of 30,000 young people, like blah, 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 whatever. But when you're talking about the football companies going, yeah, this is a big problem, says the NFL, and they're rethinking everything. And then you look at a survey like this and go, while young people are not becoming wedded to sports as a part of their lives, they weren't previous, right? I mean, this is those patterns when you're young. You don't fall in love with baseball at 50. You know, you don't start watching it every week when you're 50, at least most people don't. It's something that starts young and you stay with it through your whole life. And if they're losing a generation, they need to act fast. And having an hour-long football game take 4 hours is one damn good place to start. You know, it's four quarters of 15 minutes each, and it takes at least 3.5 hours.
And people say baseball is too long. But,
and it is. And they've been working in a few years, and they've actually... decreased, and it's a lot, 20-30 minutes. You know, that's a lot they cut out of the game. It needs to be even more, but that's why kids watch football. And by football, I mean soccer, because that damn thing's over in 2 hours no matter what.
That's right. But that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And we're going to return to the U.S. presidential election. Not to talk about the media, but what it means for the entertainment industry. So this is what people inside the beltway, so to speak, in Hollywood are talking about. So maybe inside the 405 and 101, I don't know. Here's what people are talking about. First off, how will it affect the entertainment industry? South Park had to rewrite its episode. They famously have this day after episode where they comment on the election. Well, of course, they had to rewrite the entire thing because they wrote it out as if Clinton had won. So they had to rewrite the episode, and then they titled it, "Oh, geez."
That seems like a bit of trivia.
Yes, that's pretty much. I figured let's start light, and we're running a little long, so I'm going to try and move us along. So yes, it was a bit of trivia. But then the big thing that everybody looked at was, remember when AT&T and Time Warner said they were going to, you know, merge and AT&T was going to acquire Time Warner? Do you remember what Donald J. Trump, our president-elect, said about that?
He said, nope.
Yeah, he said, no, it kind of consolidates too much power in too few hands. And he said he would not during his administration would he allow this to go through. So that deal seems to be somewhat in jeopardy, according to people like Richard Greenfield of BTIG Research. However, others say, look, there's no precedent for them to block it. They'd have to figure out a way to block it. And the Justice Department would have to figure out some way to sue AT&T over antitrust for, you know.
Well, as we pointed out, there's a whole generation of economists who reject the idea that vertical integration is good for business and good for competition. And there's a new generation saying, we don't think this is good. So there's a perfectly reasonable rationale that Young Turks may be championing. It just goes sort of counter to the pro-business people Trump will presumably put into power at the FCC. And he may not care that much about it. He said it.
Well,
off
it's
the
not
cuff.
Just the FCC; it's also the Justice Department. But yes,
and he's going to put, you know, Rudy Giuliani in charge of that, or who knows who. So, but he just may not be a topic that he feels so passionate about that he actually cares or pays attention. We'll have to find out.
Right now, that brings us to the FCC, actually. And you might recall back in 2015, net neutrality passed finally after lots of debate and lots of talk for years. The FCC, Tom Wheeler over there at the FCC, he was able to get some legislation in place that helped protect net neutrality. Well, now, of course, everybody's saying they're going to roll that back.
Right, so that can be quite unpopular with consumers, so we'll have to see. One thing that in all that coverage I didn't quite follow is that they said over the top, OTT, has been favored by the Obama administration, like over cable. Like over the top is favored by Title II and the current FCC regime. And they, I think it was one article that said it's kind of like there's been a thumb on the scale in their favor. So it really matters who's in power and what they think about it. I did not know that there was some bias in the administration towards over the top, why they would care about over the top versus cable. I mean, it's a little confusing to me, but what's going on here? What is Title II?
Why would
they favor OTT? What's going on?
We could go into this. This is a...
Well, keep it simple. Don't start with the 1934 Communications Act.
Well, that's where Title II comes from, but basically...
Well, I know, but I'm saying...
Basically, it says you cannot favor one type of communication over another, that basically it's just, if it's voice communication, it doesn't mean, you know, the president's voice going over a telephone line is no more important or less important than, you know, your grandmother's voice going over a telephone line.
That sounds like net neutrality.
That's exactly right. And so,
but that doesn't mean you're favoring over the top. That means you're just giving everyone a level playing field.
Right.
That's not favoring Netflix. That's saying you cannot favor
But
ABC over Netflix or the next company to come along that doesn't have the power that Netflix now has.
Right. And so with the Telecommunications Act of 1996, there was Section 706, which, regulated ISPs. And I mean, this gets really complicated.
Keep it simple.
The bottom line is that OTT is Netflix. It's Amazon Prime. And if all of a sudden,
and the next company you don't know about yet.
Right. And if all of a sudden Comcast says, well, you know, we have movies and we stream movies, so we're going to up the rate that it costs Netflix to stream movies so that people will pay less for our movies and Netflix can't do anything about it. That's where it looks as if the administration that is in the White House now favors OTT. What they're really saying is no. Whether it's data is data, and you can't prioritize data. That's really what they're saying,
right? And that's not pro OTT. That's just everybody plays on this. That's anti-competitive business practices.
Correct. That's really what they're saying. Now it just so happens that OTT people really like it.
Yes,
because it benefits them.
So this means. Nobody knows. You don't know who's going to be in charge of the FCC. You don't know if they're going to approve the merger. You don't know if they're going to say, hey, telephone companies, you cannot favor DirecTV streaming via its app and say that doesn't account against your data cap because that's unfair to other companies who want to have their customers stream their stuff too.
Right. So right? Much
so it's
like
a big, complicated mess. So it's uncertainty, and businesses hate uncertainty.
Right. Although you are right. Now, as you said, Michael, everybody is saying, hey, you know, Mr. President-elect, because you have, first of all, the recording industry is saying, hey, you know what? Music is, you know.
Everybody loves music.
It's bipartisan, you know, so we don't care. Hey, you know what we're doing? We're not paying attention to politics. We're, you know, weed is legal now. That's what we're focused on. Whereas the MPAA chairman, Chris Dodd, who was a Democratic senator, is saying, here's our agenda, and we hope to work constructively with the president-elect on all of these things. And that is including, jobs in all 50 states, the 2 million American jobs in all those states, and the $16.3 billion in exports that the movie industry creates.
The one industry that may not be able to say business as usual, whether they should or not, is the media in terms of newspapers and journalists, right? Donald Trump has said he's going to clamp down on the media.
He did not even pull a punch. He said, I will be suing you. Now, he didn't sue the New York Times.
He'll be suing them, but beyond that, he said the media is going to have a lot of trouble if I become elected president. He has told you he wants to clamp down on a free press. That's what he said. He made it clear. So is he going to do that? How would he do that? That is the sort of thing they have to be a little bit worried about. Do they go full hog? Do they start to do light puff pieces like People Magazine did about the new president? And then will there be blowback from that? Suddenly companies may have you think it was polarized during the Bush years. You think it was polarized during the Obama years. I don't remember any newspaper or magazine getting crap for having a light feature story about President Obama and his family. Well, guess what? People Magazine did what they did for every new president. They set up. Here's Donald Trump, our new president, and his lovely family, and their joyous journey to the White House. It's what they've done for every president for many, many years. Celebrities got very angry, didn't they? They started hashtagging all over the place. They said, no, President Trump sexually assaulted one of your People Magazine reporters, and now you're going to do a light puff piece on him? This man should not be normalized. I'm going to boycott you. It was Judd Apatow, Zoe Kazan. They're very angry. It's the day after the election. Who knows if they will continue this? Who knows if a movement will build to say, hey, we don't want you doing a puff piece about the first dog. We don't want you doing a story about Ivanka and her new clothing line or the president's sons as they go on a hunting trip.
You know what? If it makes money, they will do it.
That's my point. Will it help your brand to do that? Or will celebrities and people be angry with you and people in the public be angry with you? Will they reject that?
Well, certainly that is not something necessarily you could have called before the election. But the fact that you're asking it after the election is kind of, let's face it, should have asked that before the election.
No, I'm saying today they have to make a choice. Are they going to anger their consumers? Are they going to anger the young people, the vast majority of which who voted for the other side? And that's just normally you say, oh, well, but this day, the polarization, are they going to pay a business price for it? If they pay a business price, will they do? Do they want to anger their black, brown, and young customers by writing puff pieces about the Trump children?
Well, let's put it this way.
Will they get problems with booking celebrities? NBC thought it could not book celebrities on the Today Show because it has Billy Bush in its 9 a.m. hour. And celebrities were saying, we're not going on your show if you have Billy Bush on there. Are they going to say to NBC, I'm not going on your show if you have Ivanka Trump on to promote her new clothing line?
That's where I was headed. I was going to point out that the Billy Bush issue.
Is that a genuine concern for the businesses? I guess we'll have to wait till somebody actually tries to fight back.
Yeah, pretty much.
Do you think that's a reasonable concern? Do you think it's something that actually could
happen? Look, there are journalists saying, we're waiting for the first journalist to be jailed. We're waiting.
Who said that?
The head of BuzzFeed.
Okay.
One of the heads of BuzzFeed. Basically, that this is a very disconcerting time for journalists because they don't know how they're going to cover this presidency.
And will there be a change in their practices? If they want a soul search, it's about what they do going forward. Well, the one thing I saw was The Daily Show. They had a billboard before the election, and it said, the series finale of America, which I thought was a joke, but apparently it's not. I thought it was a very funny ad campaign. It was about the election night coverage. America, the series finale. So it's the death of America. And a couple people, of course, died this week.
This year could not get worse, really.
It could. Singer-songwriter Leon Russell died. A very famous mainstay throughout his decades in the career.
He's playing around the corner from me. December, I think it was 11th, he was supposed to play around the corner from me. Now, of course, it was postponed because he was having surgery, but now it's obviously not going to happen at all.
Really postponed. Yeah. Leon Russell died. Actor Robert Vaughn, most famous for The Man from U.N.C.L.E., died. And Canadian songwriter and poet Leonard Cohen all died. Can you blame them?
No, I was a little saddened by, of course, by Leonard Cohen. I mean, it's sad when any of these great artists pass away. Certainly Leonard Cohen is known for his song Hallelujah. Speaking of DreamWorks Animation, it was in Shrek, the original Shrek. It was also covered by Kate McKinnon as Hillary Clinton. She was playing Hillary Clinton on this week's Saturday Night Live. I wondered how they were going to cover this because, of course, they had Alec Baldwin playing Donald Trump and Kate McKinnon playing Hillary Clinton. They made fun, you know, endless fun of both of them, really. But they did a very classy thing, I thought.
Well, you know, I wasn't sad about Leonard Cohen dying because he was 82, he was frail, he was ill, and he got to go out on a high note. He released a new album called You Want It Darker. It's quite good. His last few years, he produced, for him, a rapid string of albums. You know, sometimes he went 5 or 8 years without an album. So it was great to see him go out in a creative spurt, be able to create some more music with his son as a producer, even in the pain and as you approach death, to do it in a graceful and artistically important way. So I thought it was kind of lovely.
Well, now we're going to go out on a, well, I don't know. I guess that would be a high note.
And if you had to listen to the show and you voted for Trump, I'm sorry. In every possible way.
Well, we tried to focus on the news media's coverage of it.
That's right. We're not Media Matters, and we'll get back to more entertainment-based stuff next week.
That's right. So write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Of course, you can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, or Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can rate and review the show in those podcast aggregators. Again, keep in mind, no show next week. So remember, still, follow us on Twitter, @ShowbizSandbox. Like us on Facebook, search for Showbiz Sandbox, our page should come up. All of this information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll also find all those links to the stories we covered on today's show. Again, showbizsandbox.com is where to find that information. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Gilds has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting, and I have to say, this week I'm kind of scared to ask what it is.
This week it's remember the 5th of November.com.
Wow, okay, that, you know, Google that.
You'll have to Google it if you don't know.
If you don't know, Google it. You know what, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not try the Huffington Post or michaelgilds.com, where all of his work is aggregated, including that story for the New York Post that he wrote, interviewing Donald Trump. You can also check out bookfilter.com. Some of my work is on celluloidjunkie.com. Until 2 weeks from now, play nice.